Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's November 30th, and we're going to move on with a respiratory chapter today. Maybe finish it, at least I hope we're going to finish it. Maybe we'll get into urinary system, I'm not too sure. I got a couple modifications for the urinary system PowerPoints, so just pay attention. I'll send an email out to everybody so that I can get that updated by the next lecture. There's a couple slides that are in your study guide that are not in your textbook, all right? And so I want to talk about those, so make sure you have a copy of those next week, and if I have time to point that out to you today to bring those in for the next lecture, I'll do that. All right, so don't forget, our final exam is Tuesday the 14th. That's exam 5. And I'm not quite sure what chapters are going to be on there. Let's see. So 14? Yeah, 14, cardiovascular, respiratory, and renal system for sure. I'm not so sure about digestive and diversification. So we'll just see how I can get. However, there are exercises on Blackboard for those last two chapters. So you're not going to get gypped out of getting points for those two chapters. All right, so you still have online quizzes that probably I have to activate. And those will be due on the 15th, just like all the other quizzes for this particular unit are due on the 15th. All right, so that's all I know. I had a couple emails about a quiz question on respiratory system that we'll cover today. Maybe I can remember that question and talk about it probably on the next couple slides that are coming up. So let's see. So I think we ended last time someplace around here. So let's start talking about this. Get pointer options going. Okay, let me turn some of these lights down. This one? Nope. This one. Okay, so the purpose of ventilation, of course, is to excrete CO2 and to absorb oxygen from the atmosphere, and in so doing, that also helps regulate pH in the body. As a matter of fact, you can produce an alkalosis by adjusting your respiratory rate, and I suppose you could produce an acidosis by not breathing. So what the heck is an alkalosis? What happens to pH when you're alkalotic? Your pH goes up, that's right. You're not acidic enough, okay? And so let's see why that happens. Well, we know because of Chatelier's principle. Right, if you start to hyperventilate, right, you will lose CO2 from your body by hyperventilation. Oxygen partial pressures are going to stay pretty much the same, but the pCO2s are going to decrease. Right, so what's going to happen to this chemical reaction right here if you lose CO2? Now, the delta G for this reaction pretty much is zero. It can go in either direction. So what's going to control which direction this particular equation goes, this chemical equation goes? Just the concentrations, right? Or the partial pressures of these various metabolites. So if you lose CO2, which way is it going to move? To the right or to the left? Okay. If you build up CO2 by holding your breath, it's going to move this reaction to the right. But if you hyperventilate and lose CO2, it's going to move to the left. All right, so hydrogen ion is going to combine with bicarbonate to form carbonic acid to replace the CO2 that you are excreting from your body by hyperventilating. So that depletes your body of hydrogen ions, which produces what, an acidosis or an alkalosis? That would be producing an alkalosis, right? And so by hyperventilation, then that produces a respiratory alkalosis that will raise the pH in your body. And of course, you should know the name of the enzyme that speeds this reaction up so that it's basically instantaneous, and that is the carbonic anhydrase enzyme, right? Okay, so this reaction is freely reversible. Okay, so decreased ventilation increases arterial pCO2, right? And that increases plasma CO2, and eventually that's going to get into the brain and decrease the pH of interstitial fluid, right? So CO2 goes up by looking at this equation right here. If CO2 increases, that drives the carbonic anhydrase reaction to the right, increasing hydrogen ion or decreasing pH. And there are chemoreceptors in the medulla that are sensitive to that change in pH. As a matter of fact, they're very sensitive to small changes in pH, and they will stimulate the respiratory center to increase ventilation. So the respiratory center then is going to send signals down through the spinal cord, right, to your respiratory muscles, namely, which one is that primarily? The diaphragm. And what nerve goes to the diaphragm? You should probably know that one. That is the phrenic nerve, right? And you should probably know the origins or the roots of the phrenic nerve. Your phrenic nerve is pretty low, but where does the phrenic nerve originate from? Cervical region, right? C3, 4, and 5. And the funny little saying is C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive, right? So that's why cervical spine injuries are so dangerous, because it might prevent you from ever breathing again, right, if you damage all those origins of the phrenic nerve. All right, so that increases ventilation, right? And you can see that this response right here subtracts from the initial stimulus, and so this is a nice negative feedback mechanism to maintain the proper levels of plasma CO2, right? So that is, the plasma level of CO2 indirectly affects the medulla, right? Because when CO2 enters the brain, using the carbonic anhydrase reaction once again, then that lowers the pH of the interstitial fluid of the medulla. Okay, so what else right here? Increased arterial PCO2 decreases blood pH. There are some chemoreceptors in the aortic and carotid bodies that can measure that decrease in pH, that they also will influence the respiratory center, but not to the same degree as the central receptors in the medulla itself. Right, and they'll participate in this negative feedback mechanism. So brain chemoreceptors are responsible for the greatest effects on ventilation. Now, hydrogen ions in blood or plasma can't cross the blood-brain barrier, all right, but CO2 can, because CO2 is much more, it's not as polar as a hydrogen ion right here, so it can move through membranes a lot more easily. All right, so that's why it's monitored and has its greatest effect. So hydrogen ions have its greatest effects on the central receptors, and CO2 only indirectly. So the rate and depth of ventilation is adjusted in the medulla to maintain arterial PCO2 at about 40 millimeters of mercury. So that's just the partial pressure of CO2 in the body. The peripheral chemoreceptors do not respond to PCO2, only to hydrogen ion levels. All right, so here I think maybe is an exam figure that shows, all right, plasma in this capillary right here. And then we have cerebral spinal fluid. Separating the cerebral spinal fluid from plasma is the blood-brain barrier. And of course, the cerebral spinal fluid is almost in direct contact with the neurons in the brain. There's really, just that ependymal layer right here of cells that separate the brain from cerebral spinal fluid. So hydrogen ions in this capillary right here, I guess this is a question I want to pose. Hydrogen ions, can they diffuse, okay, into cerebral spinal fluid? And they're much too polar to go across the blood-brain barrier, so only CO2 is able to do that. But once CO2 is in the cerebral spinal fluid, there is carbonic anhydrase, which catalyzes this reaction, which then converts CO2 into this hydrogen ion, and the hydrogen ion can move from the cerebral spinal fluid into the brain around these neurons. And here you have chemoreceptors for hydrogen ions. So you don't have chemoreceptors for CO2, but chemoreceptors for hydrogen ions. And that's really one of the questions that was on the online quiz. Which of these molecules in cerebral spinal fluid most directly stimulates these chemoreceptor neurons? And the answer here is hydrogen ions, because you don't have CO2 receptors on these neurons. Okay? But indirectly, CO2 does play a role, because the PCO2 of CO2 in blood does influence carbon dioxide concentration in cerebral spinal fluid, right, which then is what? Translated into hydrogen ions. Okay, so the most direct molecule is hydrogen ion. Okay, so that's a pretty important mechanism. Oxygen, on the other hand, has little effect on ventilation. Low PO2, which we call hypoxemia. If it's in blood, if it's in tissues, it's called hypoxia. Has very little effect on ventilation. But it can influence the chemoreceptor sensitivity to carbon dioxide levels. Right? Only under certain circumstances does reduced PO2 affect ventilation, and that's under extreme conditions. Right? So under extreme conditions, if it's about cut in half normal, right, then PO2 can have a significant effect on ventilation. Right, but very small changes in PCO2 will affect ventilation. When somebody has trouble ventilating due to emphysema, then that blunts the chemoreceptor response to PCO2. And oftentimes ventilation under these conditions is stimulated more by hypoxic drive rather than PCO2. All right, so certain pathological conditions, oxygen concentration makes a more powerful effect on ventilation compared to CO2, but normally it is CO2. And as a matter of fact, in buildings, I don't know if this building has any receptors, but when architects build a building and work out ventilation systems, they don't measure oxygen concentration in the air either. All right, so to turn on a ventilator inside a building, guess what molecule architects use to control when ventilation systems turn on and off? You would think it's oxygen because that's the molecule you need, but CO2 is a much more sensitive indication, and so there are CO2 receptors in buildings even to turn on ventilation systems. So that's kind of modeled after how the human body works. So here's a graph that just kind of reinforces that concept. If we look at the total minute volume, this is liters per minute, so you could think of this as like a flow or like the cardiac output of the heart in terms of ventilation. So this is a volume of air per minute that you're moving in and out of your lungs. So this is, so minute volume is ventilation of your lungs. All right, and if we look at ventilation when CO2 is varied or when oxygen is varied, so CO2 is, the scale is on the top scale, so if there's an increasing CO2, we see there is what? Increased ventilation. And the bottom graph, or this blue graph right here, which is on the bottom scale, is when oxygen is varied, when CO2 is constant. So what are we? What would we expect to increase ventilation? Not an increasing oxygen concentration, but what, a decreasing oxygen concentration? So these scales are opposite to each other, but still we overlay them on this graph right here. All right, so we see that when CO2 barely increases, all right, from maybe 5% to 6%, right, that the ventilation rate increases dramatically, like 20%. But if we vary oxygen from, say, normal around 18%, down to 12%, down to 10%, down to 8%, it hardly affects ventilation at all. All right, so it's only when oxygen concentration goes down to about 6% is there some small increase in minute volume and respiration. So the most sensitive molecule for determining ventilation is CO2 and not oxygen. And this is independent of the concentrations of each other when this experiment was completed. All right, so here is an important reflex, and we call this the Herring-Brewer reflex. Because lung tissue is fairly delicate, it can overinflate, and you can overinflate alveoli, they can rip. The Herring-Brewer reflex just stimulates the inspiratory centers in the brain and prevents overinflation of the lungs. So there are stretch receptors in the lungs that increase the rate of action potentials they send to the brain as they stretch. All right, and that can trigger the Herring-Brewer reflex so that you do not overinflate your lungs and damage the lungs due to overinflation. Okay, and the inspiratory centers, or the inhibitory centers would be, for instance, like the pneumotaxis center in the pons. Okay, because a pneumotaxis center can inhibit inspiration. All right, so let's talk about some compounds that are in blood, or actually how gases are transported in the blood. And you're going to see that it happens by two different ways. Two important compounds that we're looking at are oxygen and CO2. They're carried by two different mechanisms. Oxygen has very little ability to dissolve in water or plasma. All right, so just using water or plasma is not a good way to carry oxygen from your lungs to tissues, but CO2, on the other hand, can dissolve to a large degree. So the mechanisms are going to be totally different. So there is a compound that can bind oxygen, and that's called hemoglobin. So loading of hemoglobin with oxygen occurs in the lungs, and then it unloads in tissues so that tissues have oxygen to use. The affinity of hemoglobin for oxygen changes with a number of physiologic variables, and you're going to see that these changes in these physiologic variables helps to unload oxygen in the tissues. It will help load oxygen in the lungs and then help unload oxygen in the tissues, and that's going to just deliver oxygen to those tissues. So the compound that can carry oxygen even in fluid is hemoglobin, and we see that it has four different chains, and each one of these protein chains has a heme group embedded in it, and one oxygen molecule can bind to each of these four heme groups. So that just means that hemoglobin can carry four oxygen molecules. Right? So each hemoglobin has four globin peptide chains, right? And these four heme groups that can bind oxygen. Right? So each hemoglobin molecule can carry four oxygen molecules. So let's look at whole blood just compared to plasma in terms of how much oxygen that it can carry. So we got a little cylinder right here that it contains 100% oxygen. And we're going to open up this valve, and we're going to regulate the pressure coming out of here so that oxygen is at 100 millimeters of mercury. And then we're going to bubble that pure oxygen through plasma and through whole blood, and we're going to measure how much oxygen is contained in each of these two fluids right here at this particular pressure. So if we increase the pressure, then of course we're going to what? We're going to increase the concentration in the fluid, but we're going to maintain the partial pressure the same at 100 millimeters of mercury in both of these containers right here. All right, so by itself, just with plasma, all right, plasma can only absorb about 0.3 milliliters of oxygen for every 100 mLs of plasma. Right? That's not very much. That's about 1%. So about 1% of oxygen can be carried by plasma itself. But if we bubble oxygen through whole blood, not only do we have a little bit dissolved in plasma, right, about 1%, most of the oxygen is bound to hemoglobin. And under these conditions, right, then hemoglobin can carry, or the whole blood can carry, 20 mLs of oxygen per 100 mLs of blood. So that's an increase of about, maybe 60 to 70% increase in the carrying of oxygen when we have red blood cells with hemoglobin. So that is really important. So if we have whole blood, maybe about 1% of oxygen is transported, just dissolved in blood, and 98 or 99% of the oxygen is carried by the hemoglobin molecule. So if you're missing these hemoglobin molecules, right, you're losing the ability to transport oxygen in your tissues as a result. Okay, and we're going to come back to this slide right here. The form of hemoglobin that, when it's bound to oxygen, we call that oxyhemoglobin. All right, so we're interested in oxyhemoglobin. We'll talk about some other hemoglobins here in just a little bit, but I don't want to lose track of oxygen carrying capacity of hemoglobin. All right, so here is a table that shows the relationship between percent oxygen hemoglobin saturation and PO2. All right, at this particular pH, 7.4, all right, which is what, just a little bit alkaline, and that's a pretty good body temperature. So if we look at oxygen partial pressure, which is a way of thinking of oxygen concentration, right, as opposed to versus the percent oxyhemoglobin. What is oxyhemoglobin again? Oxyhemoglobin is when you have hemoglobin bound with those four oxygen molecules. So that's what that term means. All right, so if we have a PO2 of about 100 millimeters of mercury, which is what we find in arterial blood, then how much of the hemoglobin is bound to oxygen? That's what this table shows you right here. How much is bound to oxygen? About half? Or what? What's that number right there? 97. Okay, so almost 100% of hemoglobin is bound to oxygen, right? And each hemoglobin can carry for oxygen. So at arterial PO2s, almost 100% of hemoglobin is bound to oxygen. All right, so, but if we look on the venous end over here, so this table is kind of important because it shows you what the PO2 of arterial blood is under normal conditions and what the PO2 of venous blood is under normal conditions. It drops, okay, about from 100 millimeters of mercury down to 40 millimeters of mercury right here. All right, and so we see that now only 75% of the hemoglobin is bound to oxygen. All right, so the difference between these two places, arterial blood versus venous blood right here, is really the amount of oxygen that is being delivered to the tissues. Right, you just subtract one from the other. So there are just different ways of looking at oxygen delivery to the tissues. So, but when we look at tabulated data, it's not quite so powerful as looking at these things as a graph. So in your book, we have some nice illustrations that actually graph these points out. So we're going to plot PO2 versus the percent oxygen saturation. And when we do that, we see that it's not a straight line. It's kind of a sigmoid curve right here. So we're just plotting percent oxygen hemoglobin saturation versus PO2. And the two points that are important for you to look at is what it is in a vein. Right, the PO2 in a vein is 40, PO2 in arteries, right, under normal circumstances is 100. And so we see this nice curve right here, and the amount that's delivered to the tissues is going to be what? 75 minus 100% saturation. So that's really the number of oxygen molecules that will be delivered to these tissues right here. So that's the amount unloaded. And on the scale on the right-hand side, we just have oxygen content in mL O2 per 100 mLs of blood. All right, so this difference, right, is what is delivered to the tissues. All right, so we're interested in now looking at that dissociation curve of hemoglobin under various conditions, and one important condition is pH. So we can develop that dissociation curve just by taking whole blood and changing the pH of it and measuring, okay, the oxygen content. So at a pH of 7.4, which let's just say that's a normal pH of the blood, that's pretty close to a normal pH, maybe 7.35, something like that, 7.4 is fine. The amount of oxygen in arterial blood is 19.8 milliliters of oxygen, all right? And at the venous end, at this particular pH, remember the PO2 decreases at the venous end, and does that make sense? That you have less oxygen at the venous end compared to, say, this arterial O2 is where really what you find in the lungs, and this venous PO2 is what you have where? In the tissue. So we're really comparing, okay, hemoglobin saturation in the lungs compared to tissues, and the difference again is the amount that's unloaded. So does it make sense that the PO2 in tissues, or this venous supply here, is less than in the lungs? Because what's happening in the tissues? Oxygen is being used up, right, by mitochondria, right? So there is a concentration gradient. So since it's being used up, right, the PO2 is less, and so we subtract these two levels right here to get the amount that's actually delivered to the tissues. All right, so at a higher pH, at 7.6, hemoglobin has an increased affinity for oxygen, and that might sound like a good thing, okay? But because of the nature of that curve, let's look at the difference between the lungs and the tissues right here. So what happens as the pH increases? What happens to unloading of oxygen compared to normal conditions? Does it increase or decrease or stay the same? It actually decreases. So you have decreased oxygen unloading into tissues. That's not a beneficial circumstance. All right, so now let's look what happens at an acid pH, right? So going from 7.4 to 7.2, that's kind of a major change, but now we have decreased affinity for oxygen to hemoglobin. So we see a little bit of a decrease, right, in oxygen saturation in the lungs. So under normal conditions, 19.8 versus 19.2. But what is that difference right here? Not very big, All right, so still oxygen is binding to hemoglobin, but now let's look at the tissues. All right, so now we have much less oxygen, right, on the venous end, 14.8, which is almost 15 versus 12 right here. So we have increased unloading of oxygen to tissues when red blood cells or hemoglobin experiences an acidosis. Now, under what conditions is a tissue going to become acidic? During exercise, for instance, right? Because lactic acid is going to be produced, all right? And so that's going to lower the pH in tissues. The pH in the lungs probably will be normal, so there's going to be relatively high affinity in the lungs, relatively low affinity in exercising tissues. So we have even increased unloading of oxygen in the tissues under those conditions. So that's a beneficial circumstance. All right, so that's what you see on this graph right here. Now, this graph is plotted out a little bit more intuitively. This table right here shows a pH normal, then high, then low. But if we plot it out on a graph, we just have high, normal, and low going from left to right. All right, so what is the PO2 in tissues? It's about 40, and the PO2 in the lungs is about 100 right here. So each of these pHs, we see what? Oxygen or hemoglobin is almost 100% saturated in the lungs, but there's a big difference, right, in oxygen saturation depending on the pH in the tissues. All right, so in every case in the lungs, it's going to be about 100, but as the pH becomes more acidic, what happens to the amount that's unloaded in tissues right here? All right, this gap gets bigger and bigger and bigger as the pH decreases. So this is a nice scientific curve, right? So they measured all these different points and plotted it on this graph paper. And which way do these graphs shift as the tissues become more acidic? As the pH becomes lower, right, or more acidic, do these graphs move in a consistent way? Which way do they shift? They shift to the right. So the take-home message right here is, as the percent oxygen hemoglobin saturation curve shifts to the right, what does that mean to the tissues? This is kind of like the bottom line that you should appreciate from these curves right here. Is there more unloading as you shift to the right, or less unloading of oxygen? There's more unloading of oxygen, right? So as tissues become more acidotic, that's when hemoglobin is able to deliver more oxygen to them. And of course, that's physiologically significant, and that's what we would expect, right? That's a very nice effect of the hemoglobin. So any time you see a right shift in the oxygen saturation, that means more delivery of oxygen to tissues. All right, let's look at a couple other circumstances. Okay, there is a chemical compound called 2,3-DPG. That's diphosphoglycerate. That's almost like a glycolytic intermediate. It's a three-carbon molecule that has a phosphate group on the second position and the third position. You should know what glycerol, I think, is, right? It's a three-carbon molecule. And red blood cells not only carry hemoglobin, but they also carry 2,3-DPG. And it is regulated depending on some physiologic circumstances. For instance, if you live at high altitude, there's going to be lower pressures at high altitude, so that means that the partial pressure for oxygen will decrease. For instance, what are some cities that are really high in altitude? And maybe you've traveled to some of these cities after living in Los Angeles, which is where? Right at sea level, right? So it's not very high in altitude, but if you go to some of these cities that are high in altitude, you experience respiratory distress for a while. You have a hard time breathing, or you'll hyperventilate. Has anybody ever gone to a city like that? Like where is that? Like where?
Big Bear.
Big Bear? Yeah, that's fairly high in altitude. I forget what the elevation is at Big Bear, but it might be 4,000 feet, I think, maybe at the most. But I'm thinking of cities that are even higher than that. San Francisco's at sea level. They're right there on the ocean, too. Okay? So you're checking to see if I'm awake. I've been to San Francisco. San Francisco's a friend of mine. I know San Francisco. Okay? But I'm thinking of, like, in the United States, Denver. That's a mile high. They call it the mile high city. Seattle, that's right at sea level, too, I think. They got the Puget Sound. They got the Puget Sound right there. Okay, Aspen is probably even higher than Denver. Yeah, so if you'd like fly into Aspen, you'll experience some respiratory distress. Plus, you're probably exercising some too when you go to Aspen, like skiing, things like that. But Mexico City is about as high as Denver is. Lima, Peru, these are all capital cities, right? That's the capital city of Peru. So what happens to people when they start breathing an atmosphere that is much lower in oxygen compared to us folks that live in Los Angeles? Well, because the PO2 is decreased, there's less binding of oxygen to hemoglobin, so you have less oxyhemoglobin, okay? And as a result of that, that releases inhibition of 2,3-DPG production. All right, so 2,3-DPG is going to be inhibited under normal circumstances, and when there's less oxyhemoglobin, that inhibition is released. So the take-home message here is that 2,3-DPG, and you don't have to know the name of that molecule, but I think I said it is what? Diphosphoglycerate, right? So that's a common glycolytic intermediate. As 2,3-DPG increases, that lowers the affinity of hemoglobin for oxygen. And what does that do for the saturation curve? It shifts it to the right. Lowering the affinity shifts it to the right. And what did we say a right shift does? Increases unloading of oxygen to the tissue. So here you have a circumstance where you have less oxygen in the atmosphere. Here you have a metabolite that builds up. It causes a right shift in the oxygen binding to hemoglobin, which increases unloading to the tissue. So here is what a nice negative feedback mechanism that helps deliver oxygen to the tissues. And then when you move back down to Los Angeles, then this 2,3-DPG, okay, goes away, and then that causes a shift back to the left. So that, again, that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. So this compound, too, has been used by athletes to increase oxygen delivery to the tissues, and probably that makes a whole lot more sense. It's probably much more beneficial than just increasing the number of red blood cells, because when you increase the number of red blood cells, what happens to blood flow? It decreases because the blood becomes much more viscous, right? It's harder to pump blood loaded with red blood cells, but in this particular case, by increasing 2,3-DPG, you're not increasing the viscosity, you're just increasing the unloading of oxygen to the tissues. Yeah? You probably have an easier time delivering oxygen to your tissues as a result of that. So I think some athletes use that effect as well. They'd like to train at high altitude, and then if they're performing at a lower altitude, then they might have an advantage. Yeah, so that probably makes sense. All right, so we talked about two factors that can affect oxygen unloading to tissues. That was pH, right? So as the pH decreases, which means what? The tissue becomes more acidic, that decreases affinity, that shifts the curve to the right, that increases oxygen unloading. We call that the Bohr effect, right? So there's a molecular effect on hemoglobin when that happens that increases oxygen, okay? As 2,3-DPG increases, as oxygen in the air decreases, that shifts to the right, that increases unloading of oxygen to the tissues. All right, and then there is also temperature. And I don't think we have a temperature curve or 2,3-DPG curve. No, we sure don't. There's maybe one in your book. But as temperature increases, that also decreases the affinity of oxygen for hemoglobin, all right, which does what? That shifts the binding curve to the right. And what does that do for oxygen delivery in tissues? That increases it. Now, under what circumstances might a muscle be at high temperature? When it's exercising, and then what's the need for oxygen in that tissue when it's exercising? It's increased, right? So again, that's a very nice effect that hemoglobin has with temperature, because as you exercise a muscle under, and those are the conditions where it needs more oxygen, then the temperature increases, and so then more oxygen is delivered to the tissue as a result. So that's pretty nice. All right, so let's go back to this one slide that I skipped over right here. Now, does anybody have a question on that oxygen binding curve? All right, you just want to remember when it shifts to the right, what happens? More unloading, more delivery of oxygen to the tissues, right? And that happens with altitude, it happens with increasing temperature, it happens with increasing acidity or what? Decreasing pH. Okay, so there are some other forms of hemoglobin. Right, the one that binds oxygen. What did we call the one that binds oxygen? Hemoglobin. Yeah, it's hemoglobin is the compound, but when it binds oxygen, it becomes oxyhemoglobin. All right, there are some other compounds. Methemoglobin, right, is an oxidized form, and it contains iron in this ferric state right here, an Fe3+. And when it's three, it's usually under the ferrous state, which is a 2+ right here. It has gained an electron. It can bind oxygen, but when it's in a ferric state right here, or oxidized form, right, it lacks this ability to bind oxygen. So methemoglobin does not carry oxygen in the blood, and there's always a little bit of an equilibrium between methemoglobin and hemoglobin. There's usually very, very little in the blood. There are some circumstances where somebody is maybe toxic due to some kinds of poisons, where we can actually change the ferrous state of hemoglobin in blood to the ferric state, and that helps detoxify certain kinds of compounds. But of course, you have to be really careful with that, because if you convert everybody's hemoglobin to methemoglobin, it won't carry any oxygen. It will certainly detoxify compounds, but that person's going to die anyway because they can't carry oxygen. So clinically, it can be. You should know something about this ferric state of hemoglobin under some weird circumstances of poisoning. The other kind, talking about another kind of poisoning, okay, hemoglobin can be converted into carboxyhemoglobin, right, when heme is combined with carbon monoxide. And what the heck is, what's carbon dioxide? What does that look like?
CO2.
Yeah, CO2, all right, and carbon monoxide is just CO, right, and the reason why it's such a toxic compound is because carbon monoxide can bind to hemoglobin, and as a matter of fact, it has a higher affinity, a 210 times stronger affinity to hemoglobin than does oxygen. So when people are breathing carbon monoxide, their hemoglobin gets tied up with carbon monoxide, and when carbon monoxide is bound to that heme group, then oxygen is just pushed out of the way, and your blood cannot carry oxygen. So when you're breathing carbon monoxide, that's like having what? Somebody's hands around your throat. It's like not breathing at all, okay, because your blood just can't carry oxygen. And the reason why is because oxygen really doesn't dissolve in water. If you looked at one of those previous slides, right, only about 1% of oxygen can be carried by the blood. So how might we treat somebody? Well, I tell you what, where does carbon monoxide come from? We talk about it like it's, you know, a really serious circumstance. But where does it come from? Do you have to be worried about carbon monoxide? Anytime you burn something, right? You burn a candle, or you have charcoal in a grill or something, or gasoline in your car produces carbon monoxide. So anytime you burn a fossil fuel that produces carbon monoxide, and in a city the size of Los Angeles, there's probably about 5 people every year that die of carbon monoxide poisoning by accident because their furnaces misbehave or other things just don't go right in their house. So they fall asleep and they just don't wake up in the morning because carbon monoxide is odorless and it's colorless and you can't really tell that it's building up. So for instance, if you're lucky enough to be diagnosed with this and caught before you expire, all right, so here we have hemoglobin right here. Here's hemoglobin. Oh, here's the marker coming back. All right, and it's bound to carbon monoxide, so you can't carry oxygen. The treatment for this is hyperbaric oxygen. So you breathe oxygen because oxygen still can, right, cause carbon monoxide to dissociate, but how much oxygen do you need in order to have an equal chance of oxygen binding to hemoglobin and carbon monoxide? Where's that equilibrium point where you can get hemoglobin to dissociate from carbon monoxide? How many oxygens do I have to draw right here? I have to draw 210 of them. Well, obviously we're not going to take time to do that, but that just shows you how strong the affinity is of hemoglobin for carbon monoxide. Okay, so it can be treated All right, but it's got to be caught early. So be really careful of burning things inside your house. Or even if you go camping and you're in a little tiny tent, maybe it's in the wintertime and you burn a candle, all right, just to stay warm, there's possibly enough carbon monoxide being produced in that little confined space, all right, to negatively affect you. Because once CO2 binds to carbon monoxide binds to hemoglobin, it doesn't like to release itself. So just small concentrations of carbon monoxide over a long period of time will saturate your hemoglobin. So it's a pretty dangerous circumstance. And never try to heat your house by using, like an oven or something, or a hibachi grill or whatever, right? Because that carbon monoxide just doesn't leave. Okay, so that is two other forms of hemoglobin. Okay, so here's, I don't know how many slides we got left. Let me just see. Just a couple. Okay. So here we have a micrograph of a couple cells, examples of red blood cells. A normal red blood cell on the left over here, and you can see that it's very circular. There's a little dimple on the inside, and so it has a very smooth surface. It has a little dimple right there because that increases the surface area. All right, so why does this red blood cell, so this kind of is like what, a convolution? It's like a fold in the surface of the cell right here. So if you increase the surface area of the cell, what are you increasing? Okay, we measured something. We measured the surface area of something. And as the surface area increases, what is the physiologic consequence of that? Or what's the functional consequence? What did we measure in this room? The doorway. Yeah, so when you think of surface area, you should just automatically think of doorway, right? And as the doorway gets bigger, what increases? Exchange, right? So the shape of the cell, right, under normal conditions, has this convolution or dimple in it so that it increases the surface area for exchange. And it's nice and round and smooth so that and it's kind of flat so these cells can line up on top of each other. They can stack up and flow through blood vessels very nice and easily. Even small blood vessels like capillaries, one of these cells can go through at a time. As opposed to these red blood cells that we see over here on the right-hand side, these are cells, all right, from a patient that has sickle cell trait. And they have just one mutation in one base pair for making hemoglobin. So hemoglobin is almost the same compared to normal hemoglobin over here, just one simple mutation. And it causes these red blood cells to go from a nice round, smooth shape to one that has these jagged ends to it, like this. So it still has oxygen-carrying capacity, but these cells right here, because they're more rod-shaped with these sticky points, they have a tendency to get stuck in blood vessels, especially small blood vessels and capillaries. And, of course, capillaries is where tissue exchange takes place. All right, so people that have red blood cells that sickle, okay, have reduced blood flow to their tissues all over their body. And you're probably kind of familiar with that circumstance. Have you ever experienced a decreased blood flow to a muscle when it's contracting? And how does it feel? Like when? When does that happen? Like when you have a muscle cramp, right? Everybody's saying something I couldn't quite hear. When you have a muscle cramp, right? Blood can't get into that muscle, but it's still using up oxygen. You're still using up ATP, and it hurts like hell, right? And so you'll do anything to get that muscle to relax. So somebody that's in sickle cell crisis, guess what? That's what their whole body feels like. Okay, so you can imagine it's a really terrible circumstance, but since it can happen repeatedly, all right, what happens to tissues that don't have oxygen delivered to them? Well, they die, right? So somebody that has sickle cell trait and they go into a crisis, not only does it feel real bad, but their whole body is what? Slowly dying minute by minute. So somebody with sickle cell anemia really doesn't have a very long life and probably a fairly miserable life as well. Right, so how do we treat somebody with that kind of intractable pain? Just for pain management, right? Then they need opiates, right? So make sure you treat them with a lot of compassion. And then, of course, to help treat the condition, the underlying condition, they need transfusions as well. Okay, so They need a lot of compassion and treatment to have more or less a normal life. Now you might ask, well, how on earth did this condition ever develop? Right? Because if evolution selects for beneficial traits, why is it that, and there are other conditions that are similar to sickle cell trait, why on earth did it ever develop, and why might it be sort of prevalent in a population? Because this hemoglobin, right, is protective against malaria. All right, so in parts of the world where malaria is prevalent, then this kind of condition does protect against that disease. And probably malaria has killed maybe as many people as anything, all right, on the planet. So that's an important advantage. Unfortunately, it causes many problems besides that. Okay, so we talked about oxygen transport in the blood due to hemoglobin and how we have loading and unloading, loading in the lungs, unloading in tissues due to pH changes, right, and 2,3-DPG and temperature changes and just the nature of hemoglobin all by itself. We need to talk about CO2 transport. That's the second kind of gas that's transported in the blood. So, of course, you know that tissues produce CO2. Oh, what part of your biochemistry produces CO2? What part of your biochemistry? What part of respiration, what pathway in respiration produces CO2? Okay. Okay. It's got to be, yeah, think of Krebs cycle. Okay, that's where decarboxylations take place in the Krebs cycle. All right, so you should know like glycolysis, the prep reaction, Krebs cycle, and then oxidative phosphorylation. Don't forget about those things. Okay, those are really important, especially if you haven't taken micro yet. Guess what you're going to have to review? Your basic biochemistry, I'm sure, once again. Okay, and in many other classes. So Krebs cycle and tissues that are breaking down glucose produce CO2. All right, so CO2, again, is a nonpolar compound, so it can diffuse very easily through membranes. And CO2 is a little bit more polar than oxygen is, so guess what? More can actually dissolve in water. So plasma can actually carry about 10% of all the CO2 that a cell produces. And for oxygen, it's only about 1% or less, right? So plasma can't carry oxygen, but it can carry a little bit of CO2. Just dissolving in plasma. But CO2, once it dissolves into plasma, then it can diffuse into a red blood cell, and CO2 can combine with hemoglobin to form carbaminohemoglobin, slightly, not to the, it doesn't have the same affinity as oxygen, and when it does, it doesn't bind to the heme group, so it doesn't influence oxygen binding at all. It's not like carbon monoxide. All right, so about 20% is bound to hemoglobin. All right, so that means what? We still got to be concerned about the other 70% of the CO2 that these cells produce. So there here is another important mechanism, which is the most important. CO2 dissolves into this red blood cell, and here is an enzyme called carbonic anhydrase. And what does it do? It interconverts CO2 into carbonic acid, right? And then carbonic acid dissociates into hydrogen ions and bicarbonate. And so this hydrogen ion here can combine with hemoglobin. It has some affinity for hemoglobin, and it shifts the binding curve over, right? And then this bicarbonate will leave the cell. Bicarbonate almost, you know, it's like a salt or sugar. And how much salt or sugar can you dissolve in water? Gobs, right? I mean, you can make water so sweet or salty that you can't even drink it, right? So you can put a lot in there. Right, so same thing for bicarbonate. The body can't make enough bicarbonate to oversaturate plasma. So then bicarbonate will leave this cell, right, going down its concentration gradient into the blood. And so here we have an ion leaving. In order to maintain the electrical neutrality of this red blood cell, if we have an ion leaving the cell, what do we have to have? An anion entering the cell, right? So we have a chloride entering. All right, so now 70% of the carbon dioxide that's produced by the cell is transported as bicarbonate ion dissolved in plasma. And this chloride shift right here just helps that process happen. So the chloride shift has to do with what? CO2 transport in the blood. All right, so this is what happens in the tissues. Now this blood is eventually going to end back up where in the pulmonary circulation, and here we have a nice alveolus, And in the air that we breathe in, there's basically what? No CO2, there's high CO2 in the tissues, so the CO2 is going to diffuse out. So CO2 dissolved in plasma will diffuse into the alveolus. The CO2 that's bound to hemoglobin is going to dissociate, and that CO2 will diffuse into the alveolus. And since CO2 is decreasing, what happens to our carbonic anhydrase reaction? It shifts to the left right here, right? So it's going to, so bicarbonate is going to combine with hydrogen ion. That's going to produce carbonic acid, which then will dissociate into carbon dioxide and water. And this carbon dioxide then will diffuse into the alveolus, and then you'll ventilate that out of your body. And then we have the reverse chloride shift, right, as bicarbonate enters. So bicarbonate will enter the red blood cell based just on a concentration gradient. Okay, so this is a nice reversible process because of the carbonic anhydrase reaction. Okay, so I think that's all I need to say about that, unless somebody has a question about that. No? Okay. All right, so that's it for respiratory chapter. And that's going to take us to urinary chapter. I think I maybe have that already. So I do want to modify this urinary chapter, or at least bring in some of those figures. I don't have the figures today myself because I forgot we switched out the computers right here. So I won't be able to talk about that until next time. So let's get started with urinary system. All right, so we're going to talk about these things, structure and function of the kidney. Not too much. Some of that is just a review from anatomy, and that is so important that you know your anatomy of the kidney and something else. Otherwise, you just won't be able to follow this lecture. You got to go back and learn and relearn your anatomy of the kidney and something else. And the something else is the following. All right, what's the structural and functional unit of contraction? Sarcomere. Sarcomere, yeah, really good, really good. Okay. What's the structural and functional unit of life? Cell. All right, so structural and functional unit has what? A lot of different components all functioning together. And if you understand all those little components, if you can break that thing down into its various components and learn how they function together, then you have a really nice understanding of life and contraction. And what is that unit that you have to know to understand how cells communicate with each other? The synapse, right? It's got a bunch of pieces, and if you know how it all works, you know how communication works. All right, so here is another structural and functional unit, and that is for urine formation. What's the structural and functional unit for urine formation? That is the nephron. Okay, the nephron is. So eventually we're going to pay a lot of attention to the nephron, all the pieces and the individual functions of the nephron. And when the kidney is working properly, and this includes the nephron and some other things, right, not only does the kidney produce urine, but in this process of producing urine, it's going to control the volume of blood plasma. All right, and as your blood volume changes, what does that change? That changes your blood pressure. All right, so a couple of different ways you could think about that, because as the blood volume increases, you have increased venous return to the heart. The heart has a tendency to fill, and when it fills, it stretches. What happens to, what's that intrinsic property of the heart that changes how the heart contracts? What's that called? There's going to be, I don't know if that was on the last test or the test coming up. That intrinsic property of the heart is called the Frank-Starling law. Right, and as you stretch those sarcomeres out, then you get more optimal overlap of actin and myosin, and the contractility of the heart increases. Right, so you have increased cardiac output, which then, oh, my arrow went away, increases blood pressure. Okay, let me get this straightened out. So, increasing blood volume increases blood pressure, mostly because of that, but a nice easy way to remember that, if you have a flat tire and you want to increase the pressure inside your tire when you go to a gas station, what do? Do you take air out or you put air in? Yeah, well, you put air in, right? So when you increase the volume, that increases the pressure. Okay. Kidney also removes waste products from plasma, It helps concentrate or helps adjust concentration of electrolytes, like sodium, potassium, and bicarbonate. And also, you should think of what hydrogen ion or pH as being an electrolyte, and the kidney does that as well. There's some other functions that the kidney does, and that is that it helps regulate, and we talked about this already, it helps regulate hematocrit, right? It can stimulate red blood cell production. How does a kidney do that? It works through a hormone, right? So it helps prevent anemia by the action of what kind of hormone? What was that? That was called erythropoietin, okay? Or the genetically engineered form is EPO. So as oxygen concentration decreases, the kidney will release erythropoietin, which then goes to red bone marrow, which stimulates red blood cell production, which subtracts from the initial response. So that's another thing maybe you should put down on this slide right here. All right, well, this slide I don't think I'm going to talk about very much, but there's only four gross structures to the urinary system. You got a kidney or ureter, urinary bladder, and urethra right here, okay? And the kidney's got two main areas. Here's the cortex, then here is the medulla. Remember, the cortex is just what? It's just the superficial part of any organ. And on top of the kidney, on both kidneys, there's another organ called the adrenal gland. And remember, the adrenal gland had a cortex and a medulla as well. And so here's the kidney with the cortex, and here's the medulla, that is the deep part. And the medulla has a couple different regions, like these triangular shaped areas right here, which we call pyramids. And separating the pyramids out are these columns, which contain major blood vessels that bring arterial supply from the renal artery up into the cortex, or this junction between the cortex and the medulla. And maybe you can remember these are the arcuate arteries right here, okay, that kind of arch over the base of all of the pyramids. So in the medulla, you got pyramid, column, pyramid, column, pyramid, column. Okay, and in the cortex right here, we've got some of the initial parts of the nephron, and then in the pyramids, we have other parts of the nephron. So we want to be familiar with the structure of a nephron, and you should be able to draw that out. Okay, I don't think I'm going to take, just read over these slides right here. I think you'll understand something about that reflex. So here's a question. What's the structural and functional unit of urine formation? That is the nephron. So you got to make sure that you can draw a nephron out. All right, so it's the functional unit of the kidney. We got over a million per kidney, so it's not, they're not quite as small as an alveolus. Remember, we got like 300 million alveoli. We only have probably a couple million nephrons. And if we think of a nephron, all right, it's got two major parts to a nephron. And I don't know if anybody can remember. What are the two major parts? So I think we need to review this just a little bit. There are different two major parts to a nephron. They carry two different kinds of fluids in them. And I forgot that we don't have much in the way of markers here. This one's pretty good. What are the two major kinds of fluids that move through a nephron? We got blood, I like that one. Okay, we got blood. And then the junk that's eventually going to be urine. Yeah, and so we call that filtrate. Okay, so we've got urine and filtrate. Two different kinds of fluids. They're going to be in two different kinds of tubes. So if we have a nephron right here, all right, it's going to be broken down into basically two kinds of structures. And one of the structures, okay, is what we call vascular elements. Vascular elements. And what kind of fluid moves through a vascular element? All right, so yeah, put blood down here. So blood is moving through those kinds of tubes. And for this other component right over here, we're going to say tubular elements. Tubular elements. All right, so these are anatomical elements, and we're going to, once we understand the anatomy, we can then understand the function a little bit of what's happening here. So what kind of fluid is moving through a tubular element? Filtrate. All right, and then eventually this filtrate, once it becomes processed, going through all of the tubes and interacting with the vascular system, is going to become urine. Okay. All right, so what are some of these vascular elements? So let's just list them and then you can start drawing them out. The first vascular element is something called the afferent arteriole. What does an arteriole do? Arteriole. It's taking blood away from the heart. It's a tiny, tiny artery. But a better way of thinking of an arteriole is not what it's taking blood away from, but what is it taking blood to? A tiny, tiny artery is bringing blood to a capillary, okay? And even more importantly, what's the cool thing about a capillary compared to any other kind of vascular element? Exchange takes place there, right? Exchange takes place. So this afferent arteriole is going to take blood to a capillary. This is a special capillary. We call it the glomerulus. All right, that's a capillary. And it's a special kind of capillary because it's a fenestrated. Can anybody remember what a fenestrated capillary is? It's leaky. Yeah, it's a... I don't know about the spelling because I was talking at the same time I was writing. A fenestrated capillary is very leaky. Okay? All right, and then in a circulation, what kind of vascular element do you have after a capillary? Like you have a vein and that takes blood back to the heart. But in the kidney, there's something special. It's kind of like the hepatic portal system. You don't have one capillary bed, you have two that are connected together back to back. All right, so blood leaves the glomerulus and it goes into another portal vessel called the efferent arteriole. Efferent arteriole. All right. And what does an arteriole do? Same as this one. It delivers blood to a capillary. So here's another capillary bed. We're going to call these the peritubular capillaries. And these are regular kinds of capillaries. They're not fenestrated. These are what we call continuous capillaries. Right, peritubular capillaries. So these are capillaries around the tubes that we find that make up the nephron. All right, so that's really those are the four vascular elements that I want you to know. It's not a very extensive list. The list for the tubular elements maybe is a little bit longer, but it's not too bad. But the way that I generated this list was in the correct sequence. Like if you were to trace a drop of blood, it would go into the afferent arteriole first, and then the glomerulus, and then the efferent arteriole, right, and then the peritubular capillary. So the sequence is very particular. The same thing for these tubular elements. The most proximal one, or the first element, is what we call Bowman's capsule. That's the first element, Bowman's capsule. And so what do we have in Bowman's capsule? What kind of fluid do we have in Bowman's capsule? Well, I tell you why. What kind of fluid do we have in the peritubular capillary?
Blood.
What kind of fluid do we have in Bowman's capsule? Filtrate. Okay, indeed, that's really good. So, what kind of process puts filtrate in Bowman's capsule?
Filtration.
Exactly right. Okay, so I'm just kind of being a little funny right there, but it's relatively easy to see that, right? Okay, so you've got filtration produces fluid in Bowman's capsule, and then that filtrate moves from Bowman's capsule into a tube that has a lot of twists and turns in it. Okay, what do we call something that has a lot of twists and turns in it? Convoluted, like convolutions on the surface of the brain, right? So this is the first convoluted tubule, so we call this the proximal convoluted tubule. And what kind of fluid is in there? Filtrate, right? And then the convoluted tubule is going to connect up to something called the loop of Henle. Some of these names are changing a little bit because anatomists are trying to take people's names out of the names of something. So Bowman's capsule today sometimes is called glomerular capsule. I think they've left Henle alone so far, but you might have to translate it to be a little bit more modern. So this is maybe a little archaic, some of this terminology, loop of Henle. And then it goes to another convoluted tubule. So this is not the first one. This is then the second one, distal convoluted tubule, and then finally filtrate is going to move into a collecting duct, I'm just going to write it maybe up over here someplace. Okay, collecting duct. This is the last one. Collecting duct. And by the time that filtrate gets into the collecting duct, then we call that urine. And that urine will contain urea. All right, so those are the two elements that I want you to be able to list and in that correct order. All right, but don't forget, these things have to function together. All right, so we still got a couple minutes to do that. So I want you to be able to draw this out and then know it for next time. All right, so let's start with tubular elements first. What's the first tubular element? Bowman's capsule. All right, and so we're going to have what in there? Filtrate. Yeah, filtrate, and then that's going to flow into the proximal convoluted tubule, and that's going to flow into the loop of Henle. Right at this region right here, this is the cortical medullary junction, so everything above that is the cortex, everything below that line is the medulla. All right, so this right here, filtrate is moving down, that's what we call the descending loop of Henle. Over here is the ascending loop of Henle, and then we've got the distal convoluted tubule, and then that's going to empty into the collecting duct, which is going to go to the tip of a renal pyramid and secrete urine into a minor calyx, for instance. Okay, minor calyx. So go back and review your anatomy a little bit. All right, so what else do we have right here? Ah, vascular elements. I need a red marker. Okay, so here we have, pretend that's red. Here is blood going into Bowman's capsule via what? The afferent arteriole. Then it's going to go into this leaky capillary right here, which is the glomerulus, and then it's going to flow out, not all of the blood, right? Not all of the volume, but some volume is still going to flow out through the efferent arteriole. But now instead of going back to the heart, it goes to another capillary where exchange can take place. All right, so here's another capillary network. What do we call this capillary network? This is the peritubular capillary. And then that blood is just going to flow back out to the renal vein. So just say to renal vein, come on, marker, keep working. All right, so that's pretty good. Then how does this nephron actually produce this urine right here? Through three processes. Oh, that almost looks red. Through three processes. The first is, you already told me, that's filtration. Oh, can you see that at all? In the back, filtration. All right, so we're going to talk about this next time. Where does that happen? That happens in this renal corpuscle right here, when fluid can move from blood into Bowman's capsule. This is number one. Number one is filtration. We only got two more things to put on here, and then we can leave for today. Then tubular, and we'll talk about this, why this is so important next time, tubular reabsorption. All right, so this is when something that is in, what's this blue right here? What kind of fluid is in this blue tube? That's filtrate. When something goes from filtrate back into the blood, this is number two. So you might want to think about why that is important. We call that tubular reabsorption. And then the third process right over here is called tubular secretion. Tubular secretion. And that's when something is in this tube right here. What is this right here? What kind of fluid is in this tube? This is in what? This is in the peritubular capillary. What kind of fluid is in a capillary? Blood. So it goes from blood into the filtrate. And can you see that's different than situation number two? So this is three, right, tubular secretion. So filtration right here goes from what? Blood to filtrate. Tubular reabsorption goes from filtrate to blood. That's good. And then tubular secretion goes from blood to filtrate. And once you got these three simple processes working right here, what do you end up with in the collecting duct? You got urine. So there's only those three processes. So know the direction. Make sure you know these different components, different elements of the nephron, because I'll use them next time. So I'll be able to draw that out really fast in like a minute. Okay, thank you. And I got the sign-in sheet here if you guys need it.
Yeah.